everybody. It's time for It's All About Food. And I'm Karen Hartglass. It's August 12, 2014. Very nice day here in New York City. Cool breeze. I know I've said this every week this summer, but it has been the most incredible summer ever here where I live in New York. It has never gotten brutally hot. And I'm really liking it. I wanted to let you know, Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit, is hosting a free one-hour educational seminar on water, water safety, facts about water purification, the science behind the most effective ways of purifying water. You know I am passionate about clean, healthy water. And if you have any questions, concerns, now's the time. You can sign up and participate in this free online event. I'm really excited about it. It's the first time I'm going to be doing something like this. I'm partnering with Aquany, the people that make my favorite distiller, which is made in the United States. It's August 20th, 2014, and if you're interested, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. Go over to the right side and scroll down where it says Water Made Wonderful, and you can reserve your spot. And just above that is the link to our brand new apps. Have you downloaded your app yet, your real app? I'm so excited about those. All right. That's all I have to tell you that's new. So let's get started with today's program. And I'm going to bring on my first guest, Patrice Jones. She's an ecofeminist writer, scholar, and activist who, along with Miriam Jones, co-founded Vine Sanctuary, an LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary that operates with an understanding of the intersection of oppressions. She's the author of Aftershock, Confronting Trauma in a Violent World, a guide for activists and their allies, a wonderful book by a real favorite publisher, Lantern Books, and we are going to be talking about a new book that she has authored, The Oxen at the Intersection, another Lantern book. Patrice, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Karen. It's so great to hear your voice again.
It is good to hear your voice, and I miss you very much, and it's been way too long, and I don't know why I haven't seen you in, like, what?
10 years.
10 years. That's incredible. Well, you made a tremendous impression on me the few times that I've seen you in person, so it stays with me.
Ditto.
All right, so let's get to work here and talk about this book. Now, I remember just vaguely back in 2012, I didn't know much about the story that you talk about in this book, and I grabbed some information and read some stuff online. But this story is fascinating, frustrating, stupid, smart. It hit all my emotional buttons, and I'm continually questioning the human species and our motives. And you hit on all of them. Do you want to talk just briefly, a little introduction to get people interested in the oxen at the intersection?
Well, the oxen in question were two cows called Bill and Lou, who had been living at a college called Green Mountain College here in Vermont, where they had been used as farm equipment, yoked together by a wooden yoke and used to plow and sometimes to generate electricity. They were unofficial mascots of the school and the town of Pulteney, Vermont, until one day one of them, Lou, stepped in a gopher hole and sustained the equivalent of a sprained ankle. Not a life-threatening injury, but one that turned out to be one that meant he could no longer pull a plow. And since oxen work in teams, that meant that he and Bill could no longer work for the school. And so the school decided to kill and eat their mascots.
Mm-hmm.
And this as a symbol of sustainability. And this, not surprisingly, engendered a good bit of local controversy among townspeople who had come to care for these animals and alumni of the school who remembered them fondly. At the request of a local organization, we Vine Sanctuary stepped in to offer refuge to the oxen, who the school had said they were killing because they couldn't afford to feed them if they weren't working. So we said, that's great. We're happy to offer you a retirement home for the oxen free of charge to the college in the same way that we offer refuge to other animals when they're in circumstances where people are no longer able to feed them. And our offer was rudely refused. The question very quickly went viral due to social media, and there became a sort of a worldwide quest to, in the words of many people, save Bill and Lou. Tens and tens of thousands of people worldwide weighed in on the question. The college dug in its heels, sending out a contradictory, confusing, and stream of reasons why they had to kill these two oxen. And in the end, the local slaughterhouse refused to kill them, which left them wanting to kill but not able to do it, and they ended up splitting the difference, killing one of them and calling it euthanasia. And not allowing either of them to go to a sanctuary. And my book is, should I go on?
Please go on.
So my book, The Oxen at the Intersection, is, the whole thing was a calamity. And social change, activism proceeds by means of trial and error. If we want to make real change, we have to be willing to risk calamity. But we also have to have the discipline to look back and analyze our strategies and our tactics to see what went right and what went wrong. And so this new book of mine, The Oxen at the Intersection, is kind of a case study in calamity that tries to ask the question, how is it that tens of thousands of people were unable to save the lives of two oxen who everybody agreed had never done anyone any harm? So the first half of the book tells the story for those who were not in on it as it was happening, tells the story from our perspective here at the sanctuary, as we tried to coordinate a campaign that soon slipped the boundaries of our ability to in any way control what was happening. And then the second half of the book, which to me is the real heart of the book, analyzes what happened from several different perspectives, with the aim of learning something that might help us in future campaigns, not just animal protection campaigns, but future campaigns in activism, regardless of the type of activism.
So the first half, which is the story, to me, it was almost like a thriller. It reminded me of some whistleblower movies. I could see it as a movie, but the problem is, unlike most of the whistleblower movies that we've seen that have a happy ending, this did not have a happy ending.
Right. It did not.
It's just every page, the people at Green Mountain College, isn't that a lovely sounding name? Doesn't that make you bring up, well, maybe not for you anymore, but the images that you get are fresh air and natural environment and all good things. They had so many opportunities and they just kept making the wrong decisions.
Right. Hard-hearted decisions, decisions that didn't serve anyone really, and decisions that I'm not sure everybody. I wonder at the degree to which now there may be some regrets about decisions that were made in the heat of the moment.
I guess the one thing that surprised me above all of the opportunities that these people had to let these animals live, because you listed so many where one person or company was going to provide vegan food for the university, somebody was going to make a donation, the fact that they turned down economic-related opportunities just blew my mind because I thought everybody answered to money.
Right. But it shouldn't have blown your mind. And already you have just in talking about your own reactions to two of the aspects of this case, the images that come to your mind when you think of Green Mountain College and the failure of the college administrators to act in what would be called an economically rational way. are actually big parts of my analysis in the second half. The three sections in the second half concern the power of place, what I call dangerous intersections, meaning linkages among different forms of oppression, and animal psychology, by which I mean the psychology of human animals.
I think the second section is so important. There have been a number of books that have come out on how to be an animal advocate, but this is the best thing I've read so far because you're really working with hindsight, 2020, and it makes us understand the importance of all of the things that you're discussing.
Good.
From the story.
And I, good.
Yeah. So I just wanted to point out just a few. Can you just give a better, a more detailed description of these dangerous intersections that
absolutely.
You talk about?
Absolutely. And I also want to talk about the power of place in animal psychology. One thing I am hoping that people will read the book, obviously, or I wouldn't have written it, but I'm hoping that in addition to whatever we learned from looking at this particular case, I'm hoping that the book itself will serve as a kind of model about how to look at the problems we are trying to solve in activism. I think we need to think of the problems we are trying to solve as situations, complex intersections of material and social and psychological circumstances that need to be analyzed. And this book, I hope, provides a kind of a model of how do you look at a situation from lots of different angles to see where there might be opportunities for intervention. That's a very different way of doing activism than just seeing a problem and reaching for your one-size-fits-all tactic, whether it be a petition or pamphletings or protests, whatever the case may be. We need to get away from the knee-jerk reaching for particular favorite tactics and instead get good at analyzing situations in order to discover avenues for intervention where we can actually use rather than work against the energies that are inherent in the situation. We have to pay attention to the places that things happen. Everything that is done to animals by people is done by people. We'll get to people in a second. In particular places, places that are marked by their history, places that are shaped by material circumstances, the physiology of the ecosystem, but also by economic circumstances and the way that this particular place is hooked into national and global systems such as governments and economies. And all of these things may come into play in a particular situation. In our particular situation, the mythical image of Vermont as this green paradise, which turns out to be deeply rooted in Vermont history and an implicitly white idea, helps to explain why these college administrators in particular, but also many students, seem to feel that it was a matter of existential necessity that they be allowed to kill these animals. Because, in fact, their very sense of identity was deeply rooted in some mythological ideas about old school farming and the like. And by not recognizing the degree to which their identities were all bound up with this old school way of using oxen, which they portrayed as the natural, the true Vermont way of doing things, when in fact, actually that's the way that the European immigrants to Vermont did things, destroying the environment in the process. all of that was turned out to be relevant, and by not taking that into account adequately, that's one of the many ways we didn't do all that we could have done to save those two oxen.
You called that innocence at one point, where you know people had their understanding of the way things were, which were wrong. And when you don't know something, you don't understand something, and then you start to learn that everything you believed was wrong, many of us have a natural knee-jerk reaction to not want to believe that information because it just blows away our foundation.
Yeah. Innocence is a really important factor in the psychology of people in the United States, and particularly of white people in the United States. It's essential to believe oneself to be innocent in some sort of existential way. People are thought of as either good people or bad people, rather than thinking about good and bad acts. And thinking of people as capable of both good and bad acts. And of course, innocence depends on keeping yourself innocent of, unaware of, the violence upon which your privilege rests. And so, yeah, that was one of the many psychological factors rooted in a particular place that very strongly came in to play there. And I mentioned just now that innocence is particularly a part of white privilege, and it turns out that racism was one of many intersecting oppressions that factored into what seemed just to be a conversation among mostly white people about two animals. But in fact, whenever white people are talking among themselves, and especially when some of them are pretending to be the true carriers of the tradition of the land, race is always in there. As an unspoken and particularly virulent variable. That was certainly true in this instance.
As opposed to the people who used to live there and what they were eating and what their lifestyles were all about before we came and blew them all away.
And also ways of thinking about non-human animals, ways of growing food, et cetera. Ableism was a big issue here. Ableism is the term that we use, of course, for discrimination against, prejudice against people with disabilities. Ableism assumes that if you have particular capabilities, the having of particular capabilities makes you morally worthwhile, and not having particular capabilities makes you liable to be locked up, used, sterilized, etc. And ableism came into play in several different places here, from the very first idea that these were campus workers, that's what they had been called, these two oxen, but then when they became unable to work, then they were no longer worthy of care. That was a very disturbing element for many of the people who spoke up for Bill and Lou were not necessarily supporters of animal rights, but they were appalled by that particular idea. But there's also this implicit ableism built into speciesism, where the presumption is that people are inherently more morally worthwhile because we have particular capabilities that non-human animals don't have. And of course, we've learned over the years that most of the things we claim we can do and claim that non-human animals can't do, in fact, many other non-human animals can do quite well. Mm-hmm. But the real problem is the form of the argument. The form of the argument is that if you have certain capabilities, this is what gives you rights. This is what gives you moral worth, moral standing. This is what means we have to care about you. We have to care about you if you have rationality, and we don't have to care about you if you don't. And that's a very troubling way to think. It's the way that many people think about non-human animals, and it's deeply linked to speciesism. And then, of course, we also saw a good bit of sexism on both sides of the controversy during this one. all of that's rooted in a way of thinking about the world that some ecofeminist scholars call the logic of domination, the idea that mind over matter, reason over emotion, male over female, human over animal, culture over nature, etc.
Well, you discussed this with just using the words animal husbandry. That just sums it all up. Chilling when I read it. It's like, wow.
Yes, yes, yes. And at Green Mountain College, they actually did use that old school term, animal husbandry. And this is something that I think a lot of animal activists really have not begun to really think about anywhere near as carefully and clearly as we need to think about all uses of non-human animals by humans involves hands-on control of reproduction, and is deeply linked to sexism, and to ignore this is to ignore an essential component of the problem that you're trying to solve, and then trying to solve that problem while not looking at the ways that sex and gender play into our own ways of interacting with each other, then just compounds the problem. But when I was talking about the logic of domination, I was also sort of leading into what you said earlier when you said you were really surprised that the administrators at Green Mountain College had not behaved in an economically rational way.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of brings me to the third set of things that I talk about in my book, The Action at the Intersection, which is that this whole campaign to save Bill and Lou proceeded, for the most part, as though Bill and Lou were the only animals in question. But in fact, we're animals too. Mm-hmm. And like every other kind of animal, we have our own ethology, our own psychology, and human psychology is a lot more complicated. We are not, in fact, economically rational thinking robots.
No, we're not. We like to think we are,
but the only reason we like to think we are is that whole logic of domination that speciesism is built into. And so we had this really interesting situation, and we see it a lot in animal activism, where animal activists who absolutely oppose speciesism are still, without really being aware of that they're doing so, operating within this logic of domination where it's assumed that humans are rational. And where it's assumed that rationality is superior to emotion, and separate from emotion, and all of these are actually really odd ideas that are not in any way borne out by what we know about how people actually do act. What we know about how people actually do act is that what you think of as you, your mind, your conscious awareness, is just a really tiny sliver of the work that your brain is doing all the time. The vast majority of what your brain is doing in terms of thinking is not available to you consciously. And a lot of times your brain is making decisions and then you're coming up with some story after the fact to explain.
Okay, so we have some technical difficulties here. And Patrice, whenever you're back, let me know. And I want to say I've really enjoyed reading this book. It's just packed with so many things that will challenge your mind. And even if you thought you had it all figured out, I'm sure there are things in here that are going to, like I said, challenge you. Patrice, are you back yet? Oh, gosh, how disappointed am I? I'm going to have to call her back on another show, I think, to talk more about this. I wanted to say that I think this might just be my real favorite for 2014. That's how good a book it is. And this microcosm, this simple story, touches on so many important points. So what is discussed in the book is, in ways you would not naturally see, racism, homophobia, sexism, speciesism, how they're all connected, and they all play into this story in not obvious ways. Okay. Oh, I'm just so disappointed that she's not with us, aren't you? That was just fascinating. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about to Patrice was something called polarization. And she cited some studies that have been done where people who believe in a certain philosophy, let's say conservatives and liberals. So the conservatives will listen to their conservative podcasts, the liberals will listen to their liberal podcasts, and they will associate with people that believe and support their particular philosophy to the point where they become more so in that philosophy. And that was kind of scary to me. But apparently it's very true. She also talks about something called groupthink, which is that sheep syndrome where we all start to follow one another and we don't even realize some of the things we're agreeing to or accepting, or we're acting in certain ways without really thinking about what it is we're doing, and oftentimes it can be very dangerous. One of the things that with regard to polarization, where one group is thinking one thing and another group is thinking another, and they're becoming more so in their thoughts, is that we lose the ability to see common ground. And this is where I'm going these days. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the last two shows, and it will be on this show, I have a segment that I'm calling to myself, Preaching to the Fire, where I have someone on the program who does not agree with my view of a certain issue, and we talk about it. And I think this is so important. We did this with the documentary, The Lone Vegan, Preaching to the Fire. Have you seen it yet? And if you haven't, please go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and watch it. It's only 70 minutes, and it's another example of talking to another polarized group, a group that strongly believes in certain issues and becomes more so in their belief because they're surrounded by people and listening to people that support their belief. But if we're going to move forward, we all need to be communicating, we all need to be talking to each other, and we need to find some common ground. We need to find the areas that we agree in and focus on those and move forward. And then perhaps that way we'll learn from each other. This story, The Oxen at the Intersection, you must read it. And it's just such a classic example of humanity and ego and what we will do and the decisions we make that may not be for the best. All right, well, I guess we're not going to get Patrice. I'm very sad about that. But we'll have to have her back on and talk more about this book, okay? In the meanwhile, you get the book and you read it and let me know what you think about it. Send me an email at info@realmeals.org. Right, now let's take a break, and I will be back with Cheryl and Harley LeBon, and we're going to be talking about salt.